This is VOA 1. Play it.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Alice Bryant, Dan Novak, and Dan Friedel. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
One of Switzerland's most popular ski areas has been covering mountain areas with cloth material in an effort to reduce ice melt over the summer. Workers have placed large blankets of material around Mount Titlis, a ski area near the Swiss mountain town of Engelberg. The area contains a glacier that has been losing large amounts of ice over the past 20 years. The protective cloth, made of polyester material, is designed to block the sun. Putting the blankets over the glacier provides a natural protective shield, Gion Darms explained to Reuters. He oversees snow conditions and mountain security in the area. Decreasing snow cover resulting from higher temperatures presents a serious threat to ski areas across Europe. Having a glacier can provide some protection from climate change. It can keep large snow supplies on the mountain year-round. This snow can later be moved to fill in areas where it is needed. But the Swiss government has predicted that 90% of the country's remaining 1,500 glaciers will disappear by the end of the century if nothing is done to cut man-made pollution emissions. Darms said he has had to continually increase the size of the blankets over the glacier in recent years to save what is left. A small group of employees works over 5 to 6 weeks to cover parts of the glacier. At the end of the summer, the workers spend weeks removing the covers. Currently, the reflective material covers about 100,000 square meters, which is about the size of 14 football fields. The blankets help radiate the sun's energy back into the atmosphere. Collected snow is used to fill openings in the glacier that could open up along the area's ski runs. The snow also helps support lift structures that are fixed into the ice. I'm Brian Lynn.
Researchers used a brain cancer patient's cells to make a model of a tumor to test treatments before using them on the body. The tumor model was created with 3D printing materials. The scientists removed a piece of the tumor from a patient with glioblastoma and used it to print a model of the tumor. That explanation comes from Professor Ronit Sachi-Fainaro, who led the research at Tel Aviv University in Israel. Glioblastoma is an aggressive form of brain cancer. The patient's blood is pumped through the printed tumor, and then a drug or therapeutic treatment is pumped in. Earlier studies have used similar bioprinting methods to reproduce cancer environments. But the Tel Aviv University researchers say they are the first to print a viable tumor. Sachi Fainaro said they have about 2 weeks to test the different therapies on a tumor and find a fitting treatment for the patient. A treatment is considered promising if the printed tumor shrinks or if it lowers metabolic activity. The research was released on Wednesday in the publication Science Advances. Glioblastoma is the most common form of brain cancer in adults. It spreads quickly to other parts of the brain, making it difficult to treat. Survival is around 40% in the first year and 17% in the second. I'm Alice Bryant.
The United States federal government is giving a record amount of pandemic aid to the nation's schools. President Joe Biden's administration is hoping schools use the money to improve deep problems within the nation's school system. But many districts say they have more immediate problems to solve first. Detroit, Michigan is a poor city with a long struggling school system. The city is using the federal money to fix buildings with structural problems. The district is also using some of the government money to hire more teachers, have smaller classes, and provide more mental health services. But at least half of the $1.3 billion in federal aid is being used to repair school buildings. Nikolai Viti leads Detroit Public Schools. He said, "For decades, we have been inequitably funded to deal with the enormous needs that poverty and racial injustice have created in our city." With the pandemic money, he said, the district will finally be able to work toward fixing the problem. The Biden administration has pushed schools to make large changes with the money. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona has called it a time for big ideas. He said districts could use the money to lessen inequality. But many large city districts are putting the pandemic money towards short-term needs. Schools have used the aid to hire medical workers, put more books in libraries, and bring back art classes. "So far, there is little evidence of major change," said Marguerite Rosa. She is a school finance expert with Georgetown University. "Part of the problem," she said, "is that the aid was given to schools with few requirements about how to spend it. The money was given as blank checks to every one of these districts," Rosa said. "And many are going to do what they already know how to do." The pandemic aid is bigger than anything American schools have seen before. It totals $190 billion. That is more than four times the amount the Education Department spends on schools in a usual year. Congress has sent the funding to schools in three rounds since the start of the pandemic. The last and largest round totals $123 billion. But the government is doing little to study how schools are using the money. Some states are required to release spending plans to the federal government, but many are not. Some Republicans in Congress have pushed for a new law that would give the public more information about how districts are using the money. Reporters with the Associated Press looked at how much money was given to almost every district in the country. They tracked more than $155 billion sent to states since last year.
The median aid given to districts was nearly $2,800 per student. But that amount differs widely by district and state, the AP reports. The median funding per student in Louisiana and Washington, D.C. was about $6,000 per student. In Utah, it was $1,300. Poorer districts received much more money. Detroit received the most among big city districts at more than $25,000 per student. It was followed by Philadelphia with $13,000 per student and Cleveland at more than $12,000. Schools have 3 years to spend the latest round of funding. But districts say that is a very short amount of time to use such a large amount of money. Some school officials do not want to spend money on things they cannot pay for after the federal aid is gone. In St. Paul, Minnesota, the public school system is getting $321 million in total funding. District leader Joe Gothard says the short amount of time to spend the money limits how he can use it. The district has hired some new teachers, but it is mostly using the money for things like building repairs and replacing library books. Districts across the U.S. have spent the summer debating how to spend the new money. They have faced pressure from groups of parents and others. Some families want more money to go to special education. Others want more teacher training that examines racism. At the same time, districts are facing pressure to increase teacher pay. Sacramento, California's school district is receiving $300 million in pandemic aid. The district's teachers union has called for smaller class sizes, which would mean more teachers, as well as pay increases. The union is not asking that the funding should come from the federal aid, but the union is making the argument that the existence of the extra funding means the district can offer pay raises.
The American Federation of Teachers says the federal aid should center on improving school buildings and classroom support. But President Randy Weingarten also said pay raises are needed to keep teachers from quitting after a difficult year. Another area of concern for schools is state funding. There is worry that the federal money will give states reason to cut future education budgets. In Detroit, VD sees a chance to ask for more state funding. He hopes to show that the federal aid had improved things for students and increased graduation rates. "We're looking forward to show clear outcomes from this investment," he said. He wants to prove to state lawmakers that similar funding should be continued in an equitable way. I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about Thomas Jefferson's second term as president. Historian Joseph Ellis calls it a disaster, defined by the trade embargo and the looming War of 1812.
He leaves office in 1808, 1809. He really wants to get out of town and sort of lick his wounds.
In the months before he left office, Jefferson had signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter the United States, and no ships could leave. The purpose of the trade embargo was to keep America out of the war between Britain and France. But the embargo slowed the American economy. Many Americans opposed the trade ban. Jefferson's political opponents, the Federalists, used the issue to increase their strength in northeastern states. The year 1808 was, after all, a presidential election year. Thomas Jefferson had served 2 4-year terms as president. No law prevented him from running again. But Jefferson had decided years before that a president should be limited to 2 terms. Without such a limit, Jefferson believed, a powerful man might be able to keep the position for as long as he wished. George Washington had served 2 terms and then retired. Jefferson would do the same. Jefferson's Republican Party chose James Madison as its candidate for president. James Madison was Jefferson's Secretary of State. The party chose George Clinton as its candidate for vice president. The Federalist Party named the same candidates it had chosen 4 years earlier, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney for president and Rufus King for vice president. The Federalists felt sure they would win the election. They thought that Jefferson's embargo on trade had angered the people and turned them away from the Republican Party. Even some Republicans felt the election could go very badly for their party. But Jefferson remained calm. He believed that most Americans understood what he was trying to do with the embargo, and he believed they would vote for his party's candidate. Jefferson was right. Madison was elected. Thomas Jefferson left the White House in March of 1809. He believed the nation was in good hands with James Madison. He returned to Monticello, his country home in Virginia, and never went back to Washington again. Jefferson, who died in 1826, spent his retirement years following many of his interests. One was architecture. Jefferson continued building and remodeling his home, Monticello, throughout his presidency and retirement. The design was influenced by buildings he had seen in France and Britain. Monticello appears on one side of the American 5-cent coin, the nickel. Jefferson's face is on the other side. Jefferson also spent a good deal of his retirement writing letters. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson was one of the great letter writers of his time. One of his famous correspondences was with John Adams. Adams was the second president of the United States. Adams and Jefferson had been friends during the first years of the United States, but politics had made them enemies. Their friendship ended after the election of 1800. Yet, in retirement, the two men became friends again. Jefferson and Adams had what Andrew O'Shaughnessy calls a remarkable correspondence.
They
discuss the memory of the American Revolution and the history of it and how it should be written, but they also range over scientific and philosophical subjects.
Jefferson wrote about 19,000 letters in his lifetime. A project to publish the entire collection started in 1943 and is not expected to be completed until 2026. Jefferson also used his retirement to improve education in his home state of Virginia. Jefferson believed firmly in the value of education. His whole idea of government depended on the ability of citizens to make intelligent decisions. He proposed a school system of three steps. The first would be elementary schools, where all children could learn reading, writing, arithmetic, and geography. These schools would be built in all areas of the state and would be paid for by the people living in each area. The second step would be colleges, equivalent to the high schools of today. He proposed that 9 of these schools be built in the state. Students would begin the study of science, or would study agriculture, or how to make things by hand. These schools would be paid for by the state. The third step would be a state university, the University of Virginia, where students of great ability could get the best education possible. The university would produce the lawyers, doctors, professors, scientists, and government leaders. Young men whose families had money would pay for their own educations. The state would pay the costs of a small number of bright students from poor families. Jefferson also proposed that the University of Virginia be built at Charlottesville, a town near his home. Many of Jefferson's ideas for the university buildings came from the architecture of ancient Greece and Rome. Jefferson drew plans for the buildings. The buildings were very well designed. Work began on the university immediately, but it was 6 years before the school was open to students. Jefferson was there almost every day, watching the workers. He was quick to criticize any mistake or work that was not well done. When he was sick and not able to go down to the university, he would watch the work through a telescope from a window of his home. The cost of the university kept growing, and Jefferson had to struggle to get the legislature to pay for it. He also worked hard to get the best possible professors to teach at the university. He sent men throughout the United States and even someone to Europe to find good teachers. Finally, in March 1825, the University of Virginia opened. Jefferson's health had suffered during his years of work on the university. He was 82 years old and feeling his age. He suffered from rheumatism and diabetes and was so weak he could walk only short distances. He knew he did not have much longer to live. He told a friend one day, "When I look back over the ranks of those with whom I have lived and loved, it is like looking over a field of battle, all fallen." As his health grew worse, Jefferson turned his thoughts to death. He wrote how he wished to be buried. He wanted a simple grave on the mountainside below his house. he drew a picture of the kind of memorial he wanted put at his grave. On this stone, he wanted the statement, "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Virginia Law for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia." Jefferson had been governor of Virginia, secretary of state, and president. But historian Joseph Ellis says it makes sense that Jefferson would emphasize his contribution to the Declaration of Independence.
Those are the magic words of American history. There's 55 of them, and they begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." At the time that he wrote them, he didn't fully understand how important they were going to be. But they end up becoming the creed, the American creed. And that's his ticket to fame, the basis for his lustrous reputation.
But Joseph Ellis points out that Thomas Jefferson's reputation has suffered, especially among many historians. The reason, he says, is slavery. Jefferson owned over 150 slaves at Monticello.
He wanted to take the high moral ground and say that he knew slavery was at odds with the values of the American Revolution and the American Republic. A lot of people said that who were slave owners. But in the end, he says the federal government has no power whatsoever to do anything about it.
Joseph Ellis says Jefferson was against mixing of the races in society because he thought it would threaten the American Union. But he is believed to have had a relationship with a slave named Sally Hemings, who lived at Monticello. In 1998, genetic evidence supported the idea that Jefferson fathered children with her many years after his wife died. The historian says one reason people still find Jefferson interesting is the contradiction between his words in the Declaration of Independence and his personal actions.
He is the most resonant figure in American history because he simultaneously wrote the magic words about freedom and individual rights and equality, and at the same time was embedded in the great sin of American history, slavery and racism, so that he stands astride the great paradox that is the history of America.
On July 4th, 1826, Americans began celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. But then, from Boston, came news that former President John Adams had died. His last words were, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." But Adams was wrong. At 10 minutes before 10 in the morning, on that same 4th of July, his friend Thomas Jefferson had died. Jefferson died at Monticello in his bed, surrounded by his family. As the news of the deaths of the two great men spread across the country, the celebrations turned to mourning and sorrow. Jefferson was buried the next day, as he had ordered, in a simple grave on the quiet mountainside. Thomas Jefferson continues to influence the United States, especially his words about freedom and democracy. And Jefferson's influence remained especially strong for James Madison. The fourth president had to deal with problems with Britain that Jefferson was not able to solve.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.